Every single day I feel the
Artlist IO.
Every single day I feel the pressure. Double up the work, let's make it extra. Working so my mother get a rest, yeah. Working like I never knew I'm blessed, yeah. Every single day I feel the pressure.
Welcome back. That one's for you. It's your boy C-Rock on the What Are You Made Of show. Today I have Amy Morin in the building. She's an author, psychotherapist, mental strength trainer, and being an author, she's an international best-selling author. Her books in the 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do series have sold more than 1 million copies, probably more than that now by the time since this bio has been written, and it's been translated into over 40 languages. She's also the award-winning host of the Mentally Stronger podcast, and she gave one of the most popular TEDx talks of all time with more than 23 million views. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
What do you think about all this volume of sales and views and all this stuff? I mean, like, what are your thoughts?
It's been a wild ride. 10 years ago, I was a therapist living in rural Maine, and I worked a 9-to-5 job. Never imagined that any of this would happen. Now I get to live on a sailboat in the Florida Keys, write books, and host a podcast, and I still talk about a lot of the same things, just on a completely different level than I did when I was a therapist.
I mean, living on a sailboat in the Keys sounds really good right now.
It's not the worst place to be.
I'm in Maryland, and we've had 70 degree weather the last few weeks, and we had a softball game for my daughter last night. It was supposed to be nice yesterday. I get out there, the wind is blowing, and it felt like it was coming from where the Eskimos live.
Oh, yeah, that's rough.
So I was like, what is this? So, and we just got back from Jamaica a couple weeks ago, and I'm like, I can't deal with this. And it, by the way, it was 55 degrees, which isn't that bad. But I'm like all bundled up, shivering. And I'm like, what is this guy? Like, why am I so cold? So anyway, quick question before I get into the famous question. What is it, like, when I was in Jamaica, I was thinking about this. And I was like, I wonder if this wears off. Like living in the beautiful water, palm trees. Like, does the novelty wear off for you?
It hasn't yet. I've been on a boat for 8 years now, and I think every day I'm just amazed at the palm trees, the beautiful water, the warm weather, the later nights, and I'm reminded, especially when I call back to my friends and family in Maine and they tell me it's been dark and below zero, I just am reminded why I moved here and why I'm so grateful to be here.
Yeah, isn't Maine really Canada?
Yeah, basically. You get up like to central and northern Maine. Yeah, it's way up there.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. You know who else lives up there? I ran into Tucker Carlson. He lives in Maine.
Does he? I didn't know that.
I would have never guessed. He has a small house, and that he lives there in a small house despite all his success.
Yeah. I've heard something along those lines that he does live in a small house. That's really cool.
Crazy. Yeah. So anyway, Amy, I got to ask you the question. You ready for it?
Ready.
What are you made of?
I'd say one part mental strength, one part hope, and one part humor.
Oh, good, because we're going to get along fine then. So, I love it. All right. So, yeah, you know, the question that I ask really starts this conversation. And, you know, I love, before we even talked, I was looking, you know, doing some research. And my life, I came from a lot of brokenness. A lot of people around me, mental, you know, mental issues, mental health issues, anxiety, depression, the medication that's overprescribed in that, suicide, like all kinds of stuff. As a kid from young all the way up, watching all this happen and navigating my way through it. And so this is really, really hits home for me, you know, and I'm really interested to know your story, you know, prior to being a psychotherapist, like what led you or drew you to that? Because I think some of us, what we're doing today and our mission that we're serving stems from when we grew up in different environments, right? So everybody's got a story, Amy. What's your story?
I was an incredibly anxious kid. Like I used to throw up before school every day. And nobody could really like pinpoint why. Like I wasn't a bad student by any means. I didn't get made fun of particularly. And there was nothing like horrible about it. All I could say as a kid was it's a really long day. And I just hated every second of school with everything that I had. And was incredibly shy, quiet, just didn't want to talk, but definitely didn't want to be in school. But I did well academically, so I thought I was going to be a doctor. That was actually my first plan. And so my first day of college, I was still a pre-med student, and we were supposed to dissect cats on the second day of school. And everybody was really excited about it except for me. And I thought, yeah, I actually don't want to be a doctor. Like, I like the idea of being a doctor. And so I called my sister that day and said, I need a new major help. She was a psychology major. So I said, I'm going to switch to psychology too. And she said, don't do it. Because with a bachelor's in psychology, there's not even that like much you can do. Like, it's too broad. Become a social worker. And then you get a, at least get a license and you can do something different. So I switched my major to social work, not really knowing what I was going to do. Fell in love with it and decided to get my master's and become a therapist.
Love it. All right. So before we get into how you became an author and what you're doing now, when you were a child and had the anxiety and all that, did you ever really find the root cause of it?
Yeah, looking back now, I think it was because my mother was a stay-at-home mom for many years. I just wanted to hang out with my mom. It was more separation anxiety than anything else. And I thought, oh, if my mom gets to be at home during the day, how come I don't get to stay home? That was definitely a lot of it. And I think the other thing was because I was a really shy kid. I had some of my best friends from kindergarten are still my best friends to this day, but they weren't shy. So they spoke for me. And if I needed something, I'd whisper to them and they would ask the question for me. And every year, never fail, teachers would write on my report card, Amy is painfully shy. She never speaks up. We never hear her voice. And the more people paid attention to the fact and emphasized the fact I was shy, the harder it was to speak up. So I just became the kid that never spoke at school. And I couldn't wait to get home because I didn't shut up at home. And I just wanted to hang out with my mom and my cat mostly.
Yeah. Well, you know, the funny thing is that people, when they do this, these assessments or report cards, or what have you, they're, and when they talk to you in the school, the teachers and what have you, they're validating this over and over and over and over again.
Right. If somebody would have said, hey, Amy, that day you raised your hand was so brave. If they would have paid attention to that, then I would have gone home and thought, I'm going to try to raise my hand again tomorrow. But instead, the only reason anybody called my parents or the only reason that the only thing they ever said was, you are so shy. And so then now it's kind of funny, the fact I grew up to give this TEDx talk that was viewed by 23 million people. I was the kid that literally never raised my hand in school and never spoke. And if somebody asked me a question, I just whispered to my friends or my sister. I had an older sister who spoke for me as well. But yeah, had somebody said to me, like they had praised me for being brave one day or had said, that's great that you knew the answer or something like that. Whatever we pay attention to, people do more of. But because the emphasis was always on, you don't talk, I didn't talk.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, talking about this, like this is like a really big passion of mine because of where I came from too. And I just love teaching people different things to change their life trajectory and what the way they think of things and the way they see things. And, you know, we had a softball game. I coached softball. My daughter's 11. She's in majors now. I've coached 4 or 5 years. And we had little limited practice. I want to get your take on this. We had limited practice going into the season. And our first game, we had, at least 2 or 3 girls crying. The pitcher, you know, she was throwing a lot of balls. And then when she did throw a strike, they'd hit it. And we got smoked the first game. And the girls, and we were so focused on our practices of the fundamentals, catching, throwing, hitting, you know, running the bases. And me, the performance expert that I am, I forgot that we should be focusing on mental toughness too. But I think it's a good thing because that game happened. And then I texted my other coach and I said, hey, listen, this game we lost, who cares at this point? If it showed us nothing else is that we need to work on mental toughness, you know, and get that going. And so my wife and I bought these little journals. We call them greatness journals. And they had these little rubber frilly things on the front of it. Rainbow colors and bright and everything. And we, the next practice, we spent 10 minutes with the girls up front talking about mental toughness and writing down in your journal, your greatness journal, stories, things that you observe, things that are bothering you and your goals. And then we came out this past game and it's only a few days later and we kicked butt and then nobody cried and everybody was happy and they were cheering and yelling in the dugout, which they didn't do the first time because there was a lot of anxiety, it seemed. And just that little switch made that big a difference.
I love that. And there's so much research behind that too. If we take softball, if you step up to the plate and you're just thinking, don't strike out, don't strike out, don't strike out, because I don't want to embarrass myself, you'll probably strike out as compared to if you stepped up there and you take a deep breath, you calm your body and you think, okay, here we go. You get a strike. How do you respond to it? You think, all right, I'm going to get the next one. Or if your team's down by even 5 runs, what do you guys think? How do you start to perform? Because it affects your performance. If you think we're never going to win this game, you perform poorly compared to if you think we're going to go in there the next inning and get this. So yeah, the way you think, the way that you perform, the way that you feel when your emotions take over, if you're so anxious, you're terrified when you step into the batter's box, or you're afraid the ball's going to come to you, you're going to make many more mistakes than if you say, I'm going to do this. I'm here to win.
Yeah, it's huge. What do you think the percentage of increase in performance is? If you do think that, you shift your thinking and you think, what if we blow them out versus what if we get blown out?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know what the actual percentage would be, but I would say your performance probably increases by or improves by like 80% if I had to guess.
That's huge.
And they've done studies on this. Like golf is an easy one to study people's mentality because you're swinging at a ball. It's just you. And when they look at that and they know that walking in completely confident sometimes is not an asset. If you think 100% I've got this, then you don't keep your head in the game. A little bit of anxiety and the thought of I can do this, I'm going to do my best. People who think that way definitely perform really well. And then when they make a mistake, they can keep that in perspective. Like, okay, I'll get the next one. Or I guess in baseball specifically, like a batting slump is normal. Everybody goes through a batting slump, but it's how they respond to being in that slump. The people who say my career is over, I'm about to not be able to play anymore, I'm going to get taken out of the game, all of those thoughts make them perform way worse than somebody who says, you know, I'm batting slump's normal. I'm going to get out of it. When I do, life's going to be good again. But until then, I'm just going to ride this wave. And then there's going to be times when I do great in the batter's box, and that's okay too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, have you done any research on, so the more research I do, the more stuff, there's been a separation in the past from when I grew up and what I was observing of science and spirituality.
Yeah.
The more I study and research now, I'm seeing the link. When I look at quantum resonance, quantum mechanics, and quantum everything, I start to see this connection now, neuroscience, of spirituality and science and this link. And I'm really excited about it. But have you experienced that or witnessed that or seen any of that yourself?
Absolutely. I mean, it's amazing. You take all of the research that we've done on certain things like post-traumatic stress disorder. And what do we come back to? Like we've got all of these medications, we've got all of these options for people, treatments and therapies. And then suddenly they're like, you know, some of the things that are most effective are yoga and meditation. Like things that have been around for a really, really long time and that things that have been in the past considered just spiritual things as opposed to science-based things that can actually improve your overall well-being. So I do feel like we're making that shift and people are starting to be more open to just because something's been around for a long time doesn't mean it's not effective.
Yeah, yeah. And what about like back in the day, they used to shock patients, right? And then now the pharmaceuticals came in and then they just, the easy route is write a script, get rid of the problem. And to me, I see a conflict of interest there because there's money involved, right? Big pharma and all this. But what are your thoughts on that? And being the professional that you are from your background, like how did you navigate that conflict of interest? Because by the way, if you heal everybody you work with, you start to run out of patients.
Right.
Maybe you won't, but.
Unfortunately, like that was my job, was to work myself out of a job. Unfortunately, there was never a shortage. Even before COVID, there was 6-month waiting lists, which were common. And that's not okay to make people wait 6 months. If you want to get into a professional, we should be able to have access so that you can see somebody within a couple of days. And sadly, I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. There aren't enough mental health professionals. As a therapist, I don't prescribe medication, but I can refer people to a psychiatrist if I want them evaluated to see if medication is good for them. Medication's a wonderful tool for a lot of people. It works best when it's in conjunction with therapy. So if somebody just takes an antidepressant and they don't get treatment in terms of therapy, chances are it's not going to be as effective, but it's not for everybody. But I had plenty of people who would say, you know, I tried a medication and I actually had these side effects. Do I have to keep taking it? To which my answer was always no. Like, we don't want to introduce new problems for you or worsen certain symptoms. Like, if you can't sleep, by all means, I wouldn't take that medication either. So I think it's really a personal preference whether people want to try medication or not. We know from the research sometimes that like running can be just as effective as taking an antidepressant. But somebody who's so depressed, they feel like they can't get up off the couch, tell them to go run 3 miles. And they're going to say, like, I can't do that every day. So sometimes people say I took medication just so I felt like I had the energy to function. And then once they feel a little better, maybe they do start running or working out or doing other things so that they can manage it. But fortunately, I didn't have to make the decision. It was up to them to have that right. conversation with their doctor. And I could be part of that conversation. Here's the pros, the cons. And if you try it for a while, I think we still have a long way to go when it comes to medication. People often have to wait 4 to 6 weeks to see if something's going to be effective. When you're suffering from debilitating symptoms, waiting 6 weeks to then find out this doesn't work. And then you have to have the conversation. Does that mean I need to increase the dosage or should I try a different medication altogether? We need to figure out something much better for people than that.
Yeah, then you find I'm going on to drugs and alcohol and everything else, which is quick feeling wise or numbing, right?
Correct.
And so we wonder why we have the problem. So then also when you were working with patients and then you had your care, they were under your care, but then you had to send them out into the wild again. And I mean, what I mean by that is the media, social media, all the politics and all the stuff, the garbage that's going on, right? And that really affects people. There's this thing, I truthfully, from my research, have seen the data that I collect and I make, you know, determinations off of that, that it's some of it's intentional to make people like this, to cause chaos, and then it creates power up here and control. And so did you ever feel when you were in your everyday duty, when you were being, you know, doing the psychotherapy, that you were fighting this battle and it was like a tug of war with the world?
Oh, absolutely. Right. I mean, the symptoms of several mental health issues are things like paranoia. Well, somebody who's watching the news constantly starts to feel paranoid. So you're like, well, is that really just a symptom that's caused because you're watching the news so much and you start to feel paranoid? But then are those things factual? Or are we just feeding you those things? Or is it a mental health symptom altogether? And we know, like, from a physiological standpoint, watching the 6 o'clock news raises your blood pressure, puts you in a state of almost panic for about 20 minutes, even after you stop watching the news. So 30 years ago, when families might sit around and watch the 6 o'clock news, it was over at 6:30. By 7 p.m., everybody's nervous systems calm down and you move on with your day. Well, in today's world, where people are looking at their phones and their laptops and the TVs are on constantly and you're bombarded with news, so you think your body's in a heightened state of alert almost 24/7, unless you're proactive about getting away from it.
Yeah. Yeah. This is huge. This is huge stuff, man. And it gets worse and worse. So we need to upgrade our abilities to help people. We got to continuously work on ourselves. And so what I want to talk about next, Amy, is how and why, and was there like a catalytic moment where you made this transition to start becoming an author and then moving into doing what you're doing now?
There was. So it was an absolute accident. I didn't mean to become an author. So living in rural Maine and was a therapist, and I was 23 when my mom died. And again, my biggest fear in life was not having my mom. Even as an adult, that was a huge fear of mine. And so she passed away from a brain aneurysm. So she was fine 1 minute and gone the next. And I'd just spoken to her on the phone, in fact, earlier that evening. And it was really the first time I now had to figure out, like, mental strength isn't just about what I'm teaching people in my therapy office. This is also for me. Like, how do I stay mentally strong when I'm grieving and I feel like my heart's broken? And on the 3-year anniversary of the day that my mom died, my 26-year-old husband died. He had a heart attack. So in a similar circumstance, he was here 1 minute and gone the next. And like, that does a number on your brain when somebody is fine 1 minute and then they disappear from your life. And to have it be my mom and then my husband. And I'm supposed to be a therapist who helps other people deal with their problems. But, you know, they gave me like 3 days of bereavement time and I had to figure out, what do I do next? Well, I couldn't afford to pay the bills. And the last thing I wanted to do after my husband died was move. I felt like I've lost so much. I don't want to lose my house. So I started writing freelance articles as a way to scrape together some extra money so that I could pay my bills. And the good thing about freelance writing was I could do it in the evenings and on the weekends if I felt like I was up to it. But if I didn't do it, that was fine too. I knew I couldn't take on a second job that had a really strict schedule because I wasn't in the headspace to do that. But took years to kind of figure out which way is up, which way is down, and to work through a lot of my pain and my grief and to figure out what's next. But got remarried, got a new house, got a new job, and thought, woohoo, here we go. And my father-in-law was diagnosed with terminal cancer almost immediately. And I was like, this isn't fair. Like, I just lost two of my favorite people. Now my life starts to take a positive turn and I'm going to lose somebody else. And so I wrote myself a letter of what mentally strong people don't do. I had zero intentions of ever sharing it or making it public. It was just for me. But I found it helpful. So I thought, well, maybe somebody else will find it helpful too. And since I was already a freelance writer, I had plenty of places I could post it. So I posted it on the internet. I got paid $15 for putting it up there. And 50 million people read it. And one of those people was a literary agent who said, you should write a book. And I didn't even know what a literary agent was. And I didn't even answer her at that time. But luckily, she followed up and said, no, really, you should write a book. And I said, but I have to tell you, I'm a therapist. And people assumed, once they read that, I was all over the news, Fox News, and all of these places were calling me. They thought, oh, you mastered all of these things. And I said, but the truth is, I didn't. I struggle with all of these things. And here's my life story. But I'm not going to tell anybody with the story behind it, because I don't share my story. I'm a therapist who listens to people's stories. But I thought about it. And within a month, we had a book deal with HarperCollins, one of the biggest publishers in the world. I decided to make the story public and thought, I don't know what this is going to do to my therapy career, but here we go. The book came out within a year. And now, 10 years later, the book's in 40-something languages, and there's 6 different books.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Here's something that is very powerful for people to hear. If I do say so myself, it's funny to say that right before I'm about to say something, but no, this is powerful for me. And when you're a content producer, whether it's an author, you're podcasting on a social or whatever, the ones that are successful are the ones that are very vulnerable and transparent. And then the writing and the information that they're putting together comes from experiences that they're actually going through or have gone through recently. Right?
Yes. Because people will say, well, you became an overnight success. I'm like, you know, I wrote a lot of articles over those years that never went viral. And most of them were not anything to do with myself. In fact, this was probably the only one that came from the heart. All of my other articles were like 10 things to do in New York City on the weekend. They were just very sterile things that I would write for content mills back in the day. This was the first one that I really wrote that didn't have any science-based facts. I wasn't citing any research studies. I was just writing it from, this is my experience. And even though I didn't put in that article, this is my experience, clearly it resonated with people.
Now, I want people to read the book, of course, but what can you give a little bit from the book without ruining the book to get them to still read the book?
So basically, you know, as a therapist, I was taught to build on people's strengths. If they come into your office and they're doing some things great, you tell them that, like, keep doing those amazing things. But one of the things I thought was, you know, if I went to see a physical trainer and they told me to run on the treadmill, like, sure, I'll do it if you tell me this is going to be helpful. But I'd be incredibly upset if they didn't tell me that the junk food I ate on the way to the gym is really undoing all that hard work that I'm putting in. And so I really wanted this book to be about, no, actually, here are the bad habits that keep people stuck in life. I don't care how many good habits, but if you do this one or two of these things, you're doing some counterproductive stuff. So for instance, number one on the list is don't feel sorry for yourself, because that's where I was in my life when I wrote the list, was thinking this isn't fair. My life isn't as good as everybody else's. I had all these plans and hopes and dreams. And so I really wanted people to know, like, it's okay to be sad, but feeling sorry for yourself is different. And that would keep you stuck in life. Even if you practice gratitude for 20 minutes a day, if you feel sorry for yourself the rest of the day, the gratitude's not going to be all that productive.
This is good stuff, man. This is good stuff. So I wrote a book called Rocket Fuel, it's called Convert Setbacks, Become Unstoppable. And I have this thought. I didn't know I was doing this. Subconsciously, I was doing this all these years. I guess when I hit 40 something, I started looking back and like, why everything that I went through that seemed really bad as a kid and on up into business and everything, why did I always elevate afterwards? And I had to like investigate this, because I said, if I could figure this out and bottle this, like I could, it would be amazing. And what I found is that I was taking everything. Now, by the way, I did studies later on and learned everything is energy and how you convert energy, but I was taking everything and storing it in my tank instead of my trunk. And I was converting it into fuel, which I say is like rocket fuel because it's amazing. And so good and bad. Matter of fact, I think the bad stuff a lot of times is even more powerful energy and fuel when you convert it than it is the good stuff. Right?
Definitely. And, one of the best things we know about going through tough times is somehow you get through it. But then once you do get through it, then you realize, like, I have inner strength and skills and tools that I never even knew existed. So then when you face the next challenge, you're like, oh yeah, I got through that time. I can probably get through this one too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. And then every time you do it, the reps that you put in, You get stronger and stronger to the point where you're like, you're dealing with major, major, major things later on. And it's not even as big a deal.
Right.
You know? And the other thing I noticed too, when we're in the midst of an adversity, the closer we are to this adversity, the less light there is at the end of the tunnel, if any. And I have this thing where, like, when I'm going through tough times, number one, I try to figure out a way. I try to turn myself into a freak in a way of like, how can I enjoy this? Imagine if it's possible to enjoy a bad time. Then everything else seems like so easy. So that's number one. I kind of lean into it. And number two, I have this saying, keep going. And I had this I wrote the book Rocket Fuel, so I had this thing called thrust is a must. Winston Churchill said, if you're going through hell, keep going. Well, I don't know about you, but I don't want to just keep going. I want to go fast. So I'm always right. Like, if anytime I'm at a bad time, besides trying to embrace it, is move fast. Keep going. Just keep going. Don't think about anything. Don't dwell on anything. Just keep moving. Is that kind of something that you've experienced as well with what you went through?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's the things I can do now that I certainly didn't do before, right? I was a kid that couldn't speak in front of two people, let alone now I can get on a stage in front of 10,000. And so I was able to do that. But I also knew as a therapist, like, research will show if I give you a glass of cold lemonade and ask you to rate that glass of lemonade, you might be like, hey, this is a solid 4. If I make you mow the lawn first and you come in and you're all sweaty and I give you that glass of cold lemonade and I say 1 to 10, how is this? You're going to be like, this is a 9.5. Same lemonade, but when you've been through tough times, like the good times in life become so much more enjoyable. And if you know that the tough times aren't going to last forever, but something good is waiting for you on the other side, that cold glass of lemonade, you start to look forward to it, as you say, and then the bad times just don't seem as bad.
Yeah, the compare and contrast, compare right. And contrast, for sure. All right, so I want to know this. You met your husband, your current husband now, I guess, and were you in Maine at that time?
Yeah, yep.
Okay, so how did you talk him into doing what you did where you're going sailing now in the Keys?
So it actually was not me talking him into that. So when he was 4, his boat was decorated in the sailboat theme. He lived in Minnesota and used to go sailing with his parents on the Great Lakes. And so he always wanted to live on a sailboat. And so then when he moves to Maine with me, like, I didn't even know people lived on the sailboat. I did not live on the coast of Maine. I lived much further inland in the woods of Maine. So the idea was a bit far-fetched, but he's like, yeah, someday I'd like to live on a sailboat. And I was like, oh yeah, maybe someday. And again, then it was like one of those moments where I was like, yeah, but we're not promised someday, right? Like, we could say we're going to do this in 20 or 30 years when we're retired, but who knows if it's going to. So after my first book came out, I worked for about 1.5 years. I kept my 9-to-5 job as a therapist. And my book didn't even do that well to begin with. Like, it did okay when it hit the shelves, but it took 1.5 years before it blew up and started hitting bestseller lists. And I had this moment where I was like, but if I quit my job, I'm in rural Maine where there's only 2 therapists and it's me and my sister. And if I quit my job, like, I don't know that I'll be able to come back to the company that we worked for because they're going to fill it in and there's really no other jobs. So, but then I was like, yeah, but what if I didn't take this chance to try to write a second book? And what if I didn't? Then I would certainly regret that. So we decided sort of on a whim, like, let's move on to a boat and I'm going to write more books. And so we had a Fiat and a dog and a cat. So we moved from Maine to Florida with a Fiat, a dog, a cat, a laptop, and like 3 articles of clothing, because that's all that fits in a Fiat. And he purchased the boat. I didn't even see it beforehand. I was like, just go pick out a boat and we'll go live on it. And we weren't sure how long it would last, but it's been 8 years.
Well, like, I can't even fathom that. But the less stuff idea, right? The Fiat, yeah. Few clothing, all that. What was it like going from having a bunch of stuff, which we all know we don't really need,
right,
to not having much stuff? Like, what was that transition like?
Incredibly.
And what did you notice, like, positive from it?
So it was incredibly freeing. So when my mom had passed away, within about 2 weeks, my dad's house caught on fire. So all of my mom's stuff was smoke damaged and water damaged. And so we had to sort through it all. I ended up taking tons of stuff because we were cleaning out their closets and that kind of stuff. So that, because of the fire. So I ended up taking tons of her stuff and thinking, I'll look through that later. And then when my husband passed away, we were foster parents. We lived in a big 5-bedroom house. And I boxed a lot of his stuff up because I wasn't sure what to do with it. And I kind of felt guilty that I had all these boxes of my mom's stuff and my husband's stuff. Never really wanted to like look through it because I still didn't know what to do with it. And I kind of felt weighed down by all of this stuff that I owned. And moving down here, I realized like I really don't need that much stuff. And having like all of their stuff in boxes or with me all the time doesn't really help me honor their memory anyway. And I don't need to collect all of their stuff or keep it forever just because, you know, my husband wrote on a piece of paper once or something that he, you know, had from his childhood, things like that. It really helped me like let go of a lot of those things and the fears that I had that if I got rid of it, I'd be dishonoring them or getting rid of their memory or something like that. And just knowing when you live on a boat, you really can't even collect that much stuff anyway, because we don't have tons of room and I don't need a lot in life to be happy for sure.
It's awesome, man. I love it. There is something about matter and material stuff that's really low level emotionally.
Right.
And, you know, when we talk about, you said that freeing feeling, it's actually energy freeing up from matter into freer form of energy. You know, we all felt lighter before, walking on a cloud nine kind of thing. You know, it's a euphoric feeling. We all should strive for more of that. Less stuff.
Yep.
So, Amy, I want to thank you for being here. We're running out of time. I could talk to you for hours on this stuff, but where can people go to find more about you, get your book, wherever you want to send them?
So my website is Amy Morin, LCSW, as in licensed clinical social worker.com. And there's info about all six of my books and my podcast, which is called Mentally Stronger with Therapist Amy Morin.
Guys, go check out this podcast. I guarantee you it'll make your life better. Make sure you check out Amy. Go get her book. Let her know that you heard her here on Instagram. Go to Instagram too, Amy Morin, author, and then DM her. Let her know you heard her here. And just keep coming back, guys. We're going to keep providing you great guests. Amy, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been fun.
All right. Hang tight while I wrap this up. Folks, listen, the What Are You Made Of show is for you. It's not for me. There's some days I don't want to do this and I do it anyway because I know it's making an impact. And I want you to keep coming back. Like, subscribe, do all the things you know to do to support us as we pour into you. Please tell your friends, coworkers, and friends about us and keep coming back. And until next time, it's your boy C-Rock and the wonderful Amy Morin signing off from That One Studio on the What Are You Made Of show. Till next time, beat that one.
Music licensing reimagined.